Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
This is True Crime Cast. My name is Jamie, here with my friend and co-host John. What's up, man?
Dude, just kind of hunkered down. We've had some crazy weather in Kentucky. Tornadoes rolled through and got another round of storms recently that we thought could turn into tornadoes. So just kind of resting, but keeping one eye open kind of
thing. Yeah, it's been rough. A lot of people impacted, a lot of deaths in Kentucky. So well, you mentioned this on our other show last week, but if you're interested in giving to support the individuals affected by the storms recently, then get with us and we'll get you to the right people, because it's going to take a long time for that area to recover.
Absolutely. Jamie, this is a really, really interesting case, but before we get into it, give me something good. I need a 5-star review. What you got?
How about a couple we got over here? This comes from Kimmy429. And it says, this is about the Mad Trapper episode. Sounds a lot like Jeremiah Johnson. LOL. Loved it. I don't know if they're saying our voices or...
Yeah, I don't know. Her name reminded me of Building 421. Do you remember that band time ago?
I actually ran into them at a baseball game parking lot and talked to them for a while. Story for another time. This one comes from Minko Bub. And it just says, love how it was done. Good podcast.
Thanks, Minko.
Minko Bub and Kimmy429. Thank you both so much for reviews. Also a great way to get us requests for episodes. I think that's how we got today's request. Either that or a TikTok I stumbled upon. That's my biggest source of information right now.
All right. Well, guys, thank you. If you want more True Crime Cast and you've caught up on everything we have out available, go check out Patreon, patreon.com. You can sign up for as little as $3 a month and you'll get access to all of our bonus episodes. We release a new bonus episode only available to Patreon members at the first of every month. And as a thank you to you all, we put our regular feed on there early and ad-free.
Next month, or later this week, I guess, will be the Boston Marathon bombing story.
Yeah, dude, I remember that vividly. So I wasn't there, but that was one of those things, kind of like the Oklahoma City bombing. Like, it just kind of captivated the news, and it's terrorism.
So it stays with you. Yeah.
You never feel it changes your, in a way that I don't think people realize.
So we will dive into that head first on Patreon. But today's episode, John, I don't know. Last week we talked about Leslie Van Houten and whether or not she was brainwashed. We discussed Patty Hearst a little bit and what that means for what it means to, I guess, be accountable for your own actions. And is there a line where brainwashing can occur and it's no longer your fault? And if so, what is that line? And in this vein, also Sherry Papini has come back into the news. Famously, we covered that case within the last 2 years because it's a pretty recent case, but she's come out in the news lately defending herself after pleading guilty and spending time in prison for faking a kidnapping. So this kind of story is all in the news right now and certainly has my interest.
For sure. And I think this case runs parallel with some of those. So why don't you get the ball rolling?
Let's start off talking about Randolph Franklin Dial. He was born in Tulsa, Oklahoma on September 26, 1944. When he was just 3 years old, his parents divorced. And he also had a brother who ended up taking his own life in the late 80s. As an adult, Dial allegedly studied painting at the University of Mexico in Mexico City and worked as an art teacher in North Tulsa. What you'll find, though, as this story continues, is that Dial loved to tell a good story. And it's never very clear what's true and what's not. He had 6 children, though he claims he had 9 from several different marriages. He was first married to a woman named Christine in Mexico City. They had 1 son that was born in 1978, and then they divorced later that year. In 1998 in Tulsa, the son was charged in connection with his live-in girlfriend's death. Dial's second wife was Mary Catherine. They got married in 1979, and were divorced in 1983. They had one daughter named Rose, and Mary Catherine was mysteriously murdered in 1986 while Dial was in prison. The last known wife of Dial, her name was Robin. She was married to Dial in 1983, and they divorced in 1986, and they had one son together named Perry. So lots of kids, lots of marriages, lots of weird things surrounding his wives and his kids, and some untimely deaths.
Yeah, well, brace yourself, because it gets weirder. So he used to portray himself as a hero. He wanted everyone to think that he was the man. He told his friends so many different stories, it's really hard to keep track of. But to some friends, he told them that he was in Vietnam. He told some friends that he was a member of Delta Force, which is like a prestigious unit. He told some other friends that he was in the CIA, the FBI. He told some friends that he was a member of the Secret Service. All of these things are different, but the uniting factor is that they are all viewed by the general public as, oh, thank you for your service. You were looked upon as kind of the hero. He told others that he was a hitman with the mafia, and he had mafia connections. So to some people, he wanted to seem impressive or like in a bad guy kind of vibe. He even claimed that he was a murderer. He claimed that he committed a hired murder in 1981. And so this really was a murder, and he really was connected with it, but I don't think we have a full picture of what actually the motive was. But let me tell you about this. So Dial showed up to a house in Broken Arrow, and it was the home of a karate instructor named Kelly Hogan. So he got to the house. He asked Hogan's wife, who answered the door, some questions. This was at like 10 o'clock at night. And then Dial shot Hogan, left the house. He never actually went in, so there were no fingerprints. There was nothing to go off of other than Hogan's wife's visual of this man who she had never met before. So this guy just kind of disappeared for years. This case went unsolved until 1986. Again, this was in 1981 when the murder actually happened. You want to know how it was solved? Well, he turned himself in. So police were not on his tail. It wasn't like he was getting pressure. He told police that he was hired by a Kansas City mob member to be a hitman and kill Hogan, but was concerned that he was the next target. Years later, he told a different story altogether. He said that he actually killed a man that he thought was dealing drugs to one of his kids. And when he found out that that was a mistake, he turned himself in. I don't know what to believe here, Jamie. This is a fascinating story about Hogan, because Hogan was a karate instructor. He had grown up, loved karate, and was studied under an instructor in his area. They kind of had a falling out, if you will, and then he opened up his own dojo. So it was almost like a Karate Kid situation where you have these once friends who are now rivals. So there was a lot of harassing things going on in Hogan's life, and he at the time thought it was his friend that's turned rival trying to get him to stop being an instructor. So for years, people suspected that his rival dojo slash friend at one time was responsible for his death.
This is what I believe. Very little to none of anything that Dial says. And it's so tough because, I mean, any good lie is sprinkled with the truth. And I think he was actually pretty good at doing that. As far as turning himself in, if he was scared for his life, maybe that happens sometimes. But you also wonder, a lot of people who give confessions, I guess there are a lot of people who give false confessions, is what I'm trying to say. After he'd spent several years in prison, Dial was transferred to a minimum security unit at the Oklahoma State Reformatory. While he was there, he was a model prisoner, so like most, he was given special privileges and good positions within the prison. He was allowed, for example, to work at the staff wellness center. Warden Jack Cowley assigned him to work there as a janitor, a towel boy, and to paint murals on the walls. Again, he was an artist, remember? And it was there that Dial met our next character in the story, Bobby Parker. Bobby was married to the deputy warden named Randy Parker, and he met her there at the prison. Bobby and Randy had two young daughters, and they lived with their daughters on the grounds of the prison right next to the medium security facility where Dial lived. When Bobby started going to the wellness center, she met Dial, and as they got to know each other, she said, "You know what? I'm here to try to lose 20 pounds." So Dial said, "I think I can help." He gave her some advice. He walked with her twice a week around the track. And of course, while you're walking on the track or on the treadmill, that's a really good time to talk and get to know somebody. And this was a guy who, yes, he was a prisoner, but obviously he was trusted and valued within the prison. And they were spending a lot of time together, John. That's always a questionable situation.
And just so everybody's on the same page, and you said it correctly, I just want to make sure we're all tracking. There's a lot of names. So Bobby Parker is the wife of the deputy warden.
Mrs. Bobby Parker.
Named Randy Parker. It's, you know, you got to watch those guys with names that could be feminine, you know?
Thanks, buddy.
No, so Randy and Bobby. Bobby is now talking to Dial. And, I mean, just right off the bat, seems like some boundary issues. I mean, I don't know. I don't live in a prison, and she's used to this kind of population. Her husband was a warden for a long, long, long time. So,
but she didn't work there, to be clear. She lived there.
Yeah, she was a stay-at-home mom. So she, yeah, I don't know. It will get more clear as we go. So Dial was assigned to paint a mural along the wall of Bobby's husband's office. Again, that's the warden. Dial said during the hours that he spent there doing that, both Parkers came in and out, and he got to know both of them very well. He eventually convinced the officers and the officials there to let him start an arts program. And to get them to buy into it, he said that they would sell the art and they could use that money for rehabilitation services for the inmates. So this seemed like it's a win-win. Bobby was already running an inmate pottery program, so they agreed to it. And they let him do this. So Dial was actually using the kiln at the Parker's garage. And if you're not familiar with the kiln, if you're doing pottery, ceramic work, you create it, you have this finished product and it's soft, you put it in this kiln, it's super hot, it heats it up and hardens it. So it takes a special electrical outlet, like you have a lot of electricity running to this thing. And apparently the Parker's garage is where this kiln was used. So Dial became a daily fixture inside the Parker home. So he was, even though he was in jail or in prison for murder, he had accumulated enough, I guess, brownie points, if you will, with prison officials that they did not view him as a threat to anyone. He was allowed to kind of, you know, their house is on the property, so it's not like he's leaving the prison and coming back whenever he wants, but he's on the grounds, but just kind of free to roam kind of wherever he wants on the premises.
Which is wild to me. And I get that people kind of earn trust and that kind of thing, but he's still in prison for a murder. So it's not like he's there, I don't know, in a traffic ticket and he's never been a threat. Like, he's been convicted of killing somebody. So I think he has to be a threat. And he was certainly a threat to the Parker's marriage. When we get back from the break, we'll talk about how the relationship between Dial and Bobby Parker really heated up around that kill.
I'd like to just say that I saw what you did there, and I love it. Continue.
Oh, yeah, thanks. I didn't know if picked up on it. So they're in the garage. That's where we're going to start out. The day is August 3rd, 1994. Randy Parker left for work, and as usual, he saw Dial working in his garage. When he came home that afternoon, though, his wife Bobby wasn't there. Again, stay-at-home mom. Hadn't told him she was going anywhere. She did leave a note that said that she had gone shopping. So kind of odd to just leave a note, not talk to him. But he's like, you know what? It's fine. I'll just go throughout my day and she'll be back for dinner, surely. And it took until the evening before he started to get worried. That's when he realized that he also hadn't seen Dial since that morning. Randolph Dial was in his garage when he left. He came home, his wife is gone, and Dial's gone. He asked an officer to go and check Dial's cell, and of course it was discovered that he wasn't there. So Randy was worried that Dial had somehow escaped or had decided to hurt Bobby in order to escape or even abducted her to take him with her. He searched for his wife. He got help from volunteers, but there was no sign of Bobby anywhere. One inmate, though, claimed that he did see Dial get into a car before Bobby drove him away. So an inmate is claiming, "I saw them leave together." Bobby's van was discovered 2 days later, abandoned in Wichita Falls, Texas. Police considered Bobby an endangered missing person, so the general idea was that she had been abducted by Dial, again a convicted murderer who was in her house each and every day. They were worried that she was being held against her will and possibly already injured or killed. 8 days after the van was discovered, a member of Bobby's family got a phone call saying that she would be home soon and asked that they would take care of her children until she got there.
So that same morning, and we have some testimony that we'll kind of tell you more about later, but for now, the version of the story that we have is that Bobby got into her van that morning, and little did she know, Dial was actually hiding in her van. When she got in, Dial held a knife to her and told her to drive to Wichita Falls. As Bobby cried and screamed, Dial says that he reassured her. He said, "Look, in the morning I'll turn you loose, but tonight I'm going to tie you up. I'm not going to molest you, do anything like that, but I've got to get some sleep." So they left the van behind. They took a taxi to Fort Worth. Then from there, they took a bus to Houston. And then from there, a taxi to Galveston. The entire way, Dial said that he made Bobby drink wine and allowed her to make a few phone calls here and there. But that's when she called her family, not her husband, to make sure that her children knew that she loved them and that she would be home soon. Dial's original plan was to go to Mexico, but at some point that plan fell through, along with his plans to let Bobby go home.
And again, she is at this point thought of as a kidnapped person. She's allowed to make a phone call, but does not call her husband, which I think is an important thing to note. Dial took Bobby along with him as they stayed in really gross motels. They stayed in homeless shelters. He said the whole time he was complimenting her on how she looked and the way she talked, and he started holding doors for her. So he went from holding her hostage and promising to let her go to essentially trying to woo her. Is that the right description that we're going for here?
Sure.
One night, just before Christmas in 1994, Dial bought a lot of wine for both of them and told Bobby that he was in love with her. According to Dial, she reciprocated, and then the two made love that night. The next morning, Dial told Bobby, "Look, here's what I'll do. If you'll stay with me for a while, not try to run away, I'll treat you good and I'll find us some work and we'll get out of here." He did, however, continue to keep her tied up, and he scared her with threats of going back and harming her family and children. Charles Sasser, who is a writer and a former Tulsa homicide detective, wrote a book based on Dial's case called At Large. While Dial and Bobby were still on the run or missing, depending on how you want to look at it. In 2001, 7 years after Dial's escape, he called Sasser to say he had read the book 12 times and told him, "You weren't always complimentary to me, but you're always fair and objective." John, if I'm on the run, I think calling a person who wrote a book about me, or calling really anybody who knows who I am, it's probably going to be off the books. I don't think I'm going
to
do that.
But at the same time, for him, it tracks, right? Like, I go back to his ego. He always has to have the large ego. He would tell everybody that he was this prominent war vet or a member of the Secret Service, these, you know, high prestige careers. So now he's calling this guy to, I don't know, kind of taunt. It's almost like a taunting thing, right?
It's
like,
yeah,
I'm aware.
Yeah, it's pretty much like, I know you wrote this book about me, but it was all about me. It's always all about me is the kind of the vibe I get. So Sasser asked about Bobby, and Dial said she was doing fine, even putting her on the phone. Sasser asked three questions that only Bobby would have known the answers to make sure he was talking to the right person. Because at this point, it had been 7 years. People didn't know if she was missing or dead. He asked how she was and told her to call her family and let them know she was okay. Then they discussed that she thought maybe it was just better off for them to keep thinking that she was dead. She didn't know whether she should call him or not. So Sasser spoke to Dial for about an hour and immediately called the FBI. FBI attempted to trace the call, but they were unable to do so. This was 2001, John. I figure it'd be pretty easy to trace a phone call by then.
Yeah, you'd think at that time everybody has like caller ID, or you could have like, what was the Star 67?
But I mean, surely the FBI can get around that, right?
Yeah, I mean, but even if you didn't have a caller ID, you could do like Star 61 or something like that to get your last call.
Oh, that number? Was Star 69. Star 67 blocked it from happening.
Okay,
gotcha. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, that's how I did a lot of prank calls back in the day.
Yeah, it was.
But in 2005, 11 years after the escape, someone called in the tip line for America's Most Wanted. Used to love that show, especially at this time. So that's awesome.
It was peak.
So they called in. They said that they saw Dial's face on the show and that they actually saw someone who looked like her working on a chicken farm in Campy, Texas. So on April 4th, 2005, police swarmed a mobile home at that rural chicken farm in the woods. This is near the Louisiana border. And that's where they found Dial and Bobby living under the names of Richard and Samantha Dale. So Dial was actually in the middle of cooking a steak for supper. And he told officials, "I'd been thinking of when you were going to catch me. I'd been looking for it, but I never saw this coming." Dial was immediately arrested peacefully, but there was a loaded pistol found on a nearby table and a shotgun by the door. Both Dial and Bobby maintained that Bobby was being held there against her will.
And that's where the question comes in, right? This is, at this point, 11 years after they had gone missing, and she's claiming that she didn't want to be there, and you start asking yourself, were there opportunities to escape? Was she afraid to try to escape? Was she brainwashed? And that's all stuff we'll get into here in a bit. Those who live nearby, though, said that they always felt like something was off with the couple. They kept to themselves and never engaged in community events, really personal conversations. They said Bobby was nice, but Dial remained cold and distant. In fact, people who did approach the secluded trailer were typically met with Dial holding a gun, demanding to know who they were and what they wanted. Which, honestly, John, chicken farm, Texas, I'd say that's not too uncommon. For work, coworkers said Dial was fired from the chicken farm and that he pressured Bobby to take on extra hours to make up the difference so that he didn't have to go back to work. When neighbors asked why Dial wasn't working, Bobby would nervously explain that he was too sick. But people who stopped by said Dial continued to work on his art, including sculptures at home, while Bobby worked in these brutally hot conditions, so he seemed just fine when it came to doing what he wanted to do. Bobby, who is now 42 years old, was reunited with her husband, again Randy Parker, who was the deputy warden at the prison that Dial escaped from. Texas Rangers said, "It looked like a husband and wife who hadn't seen each other in 11 years. So it was as people had expected. It was a tearful reunion." Randy noticed that Bobby had a hard time talking about her experience with Dial, and I think that's probably expected. Somebody's been kidnapped for over a decade. I doubt they're going to want to tell you about every awful thing that happened. They're going to want to, I guess, rejoice in being away from that for a bit. Randy also noticed differences in her behavior. Like, she asked permission when it was time to go to the bathroom, or she asked permission if she could go get herself something from the refrigerator in the house, which was not something she would have ever done before she left with Dial.
So definitely looks like this is behavior that she's picked up because she's been held captive and she, you know, was living basically as a not free person, right? So meanwhile, in Texas, agents from Oklahoma SPI were making some puzzling discoveries in a mobile home on the chicken farm that they were found in. So agents found several things: condoms, sex toys, and numerous Valentine's Day cards the pair had exchanged. While the two claimed that Bobby was there against her will, they did find out that Dial often sent Bobby into town for errands, including going to the grocery store by herself, which was right across the street from the police station. Now, Bobby would always claim that she was just too afraid to venture off the path that he had put her on because he had ties to the mafia, and if she ever tried anything fishy, then he would, you know, always have those connections that would show up and off her, you know. Chief Deputy Kent Schaefer noted, "She could have driven to this police office instead. We would sure as the world helped her, and I can guarantee you that," is what he said. When Bobby did run the errands, the town noticed that she wore a straw gardener's hat that was pulled tightly down on to kind of cover her face, and then she also would wear a scarf. She would wear a baggy dress. They all joked that she was in disguise wherever she went, and little did they know, that's actually true. She was actually trying to look like someone else or look unrecognizable.
Yeah, she was still on the run, and again, being held captive, whether you want to say she was afraid to go to the police station or not, I think she probably could have gotten away with people recognizing her in public, but she is making efforts to ensure that nobody knows who she is. Another suspicious event happened in 2004, around a year before they were discovered, when Dial had a heart attack and was rushed to the hospital. There was seemingly another opportunity to escape. I mean, not only was he at the hospital, but he was in bad shape. If you have a heart attack, the recovery is brutal.
You know what you can't do if you're in the hospital for a heart attack? Call the mafia that you say you have a connection with.
Not with that attitude. So she told authorities that Dial had drugged her and kidnapped her, and they actually found out that Bobby wrote Dial a love letter while he was in the hospital and stayed by his side. And despite evidence of her love, of her lovemaking, of her writing these notes and disguising herself and her avoiding ways that she could escape, she told authorities that he beat her mercilessly and that he occasionally would brutally rape her. She said that she was bound to Dial because he always threatened her family. She wasn't necessarily worried about herself. She was worried about her kids. And he told her if she even approached a cop, that he would hurt her family. Now, Sasser, again, who wrote the book, he talked to her in 2001 and said when he talked to Bobby then, neither of them made it sound like she was being held against her will. It sounded like he was talking to a couple hanging out at home. He said, "I don't believe it. I spoke to her and told her to call her children," end quote. So he certainly, who researched Dial more than anybody else, didn't seem to buy this story.
Dial's first interview with Oklahoma SBI was 2.5 hours long, and in it he said, "I was a hostage taker and will probably live to regret it, but now I don't. Doing a life sentence at my age, I wouldn't trade it for the past 10.5 years. He said that their relationship was never romantic and that they lived in separate rooms. Dial said it was likely that Bobby had Stockholm syndrome, which we've spoke about, where, you know, basically you are afraid, you're kidnapped, but all of a sudden things change and now you're kind of connected to your oppressor, basically.
Yeah.
He said that she was living under the impression that if she ever tried to get away, then I would get away and I would make her regret it, particularly toward her family. I didn't mean it, but she didn't know that, he said. Dial was sentenced on February 2nd, 2007 to 7 years for his escape from prison. That was added on top of the previous life sentence of murder. Remember, because he escaped from jail, he was not supposed to be out. He continued to insist that Bobby had no role in his escape. Dial said that he simply seized an opportunity, knowing that Bobby was planning on going shopping that day, so he wouldn't be expected home, or she wouldn't be expected home, and that would give him a chance to get far away before anyone would ever have a chance to notice. And when asked if Dial thought Bobby loved him back, his answers were ambiguous. But one thing was clear: he wanted to make sure Bobby was not persecuted as an accomplice. He told authorities, save yourself some trouble. That girl cannot be convicted because when I get on the stand and I convince the jury and I speak my language, I'll tell them I kidnapped her. So you're wasting your time. Dial ended up dying in prison from complications surrounding lung cancer. He died in prison on June 13th, 2007.
So he has said, I will testify to keep her out of prison. And just a couple years after he's brought back in prison, he is no longer alive. So fast forward just a few months in April of 2008, almost 3 years after being brought home from the chicken farm, Bobby was arrested and charged with felony charges of helping Dial escape from prison. It took another 3 years of gathering evidence and court motions before we finally get to trial. Prosecutors allege that Bobby was in love with Dial, that she helped him escape, and that she not only wanted him out of prison, but orchestrated it so that she could be with him. Her defense maintained that she had been drugged, she had been kidnapped, and she was repeatedly assaulted, preventing her from feeling safe trying to seek shelter or escape. They also presented a previous psychological report from the Oklahoma State Reformatory confirming that Dial himself was very manipulative, especially around women.
So the trial featured more than 80 witnesses and over 800 pieces of evidence. That seems like a lot. I'd like to talk to all of our attorney friends to see, like, what's an average amount of evidence, but that's a lot for...
It feels like a lot.
But I mean, again, she's held captive for, what, 10 years? So lots of opportunities maybe to gather this evidence. In September of 2011, this case would finally go to a jury to learn the fate of Bobby Parker, and she was found guilty of smuggling or helping a convicted killer escape jail. I said smuggling. But in a lot of ways, it was like she smuggled him when all this time they thought that maybe he smuggled her.
Well, I mean, I think it sounds like they pretty much just went and got in her car and took off. There wasn't much to hide till they got out of town.
They spent about 3 days deliberating on this and recommended Bobby spend 1 year in prison. That seems like a light sentence. We can talk more about that in a minute. But she only ended up serving 6 months and was released on April 6th, 2012. Today, Bobby is still married to her husband, Randy. They live in Oklahoma. Bobby has built a wonderful relationship with her two daughters. Yeah, dude, I'm getting divorced. That's for sure.
So. Yeah, and in any picture that you find of Bobby since she was recovered, Randy is right there. He was by her side during her trial. He was by her side when she got out. His dedication to her is unmatched, and it really seems like he believes the story, which I think is a pretty implausible story to believe. And again, I realize that brainwashing is a thing, that manipulation, gaslighting, all of these are, I don't know, are key words in psychology and very popular concepts for good reason. But for her case, it really just seems like she wanted to escape with Dial and be away from her husband.
Yeah, I mean, let's remember where this all started. They would take walks together on the track at the prison. I even read that he would come over and they would sit on the swing of their front porch, like Bobby's front porch.
Oh, man, front porch swinging where I'm from? That's pretty much a marriage proposal.
There's a whole song about it, you know?
Just a swing. Yes, sir.
So, yeah, I mean, I personally think it's very clear to see what happened here. I think she got wrapped up. Maybe things weren't going great at home, and our pastor phrases it in maybe an odd way, but I've always remembered this, like, you have a bank emotionally, and you're either getting deposits or withdrawals, and maybe perhaps her and Randy were having some issues, and he wasn't making regular deposits, but then she met this guy, and maybe he was making the deposits that she needed. So,
and maybe there were moments when she mentioned going home, when she missed her kids or whatever. And maybe in those moments he did make a threat. But I think overall, this was something that she got into intentionally. I'm glad she was held accountable for it, but you wanted to talk about her sentence as well.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you help somebody escape prison and then, I guess it's not really a crime to leave your family, you know, and leave the children behind for 10 years now, it's maybe not a crime, but you can have your children removed for that. It's called abandonment. It's not a, not something you go to prison for, but yeah, you helped a murder inmate escape prison. You go to jail for a long time in my book, not 6 months.
Yeah, I think if they could prove that anybody was hurt or killed by Dial after getting him out, that she certainly would have served a higher sentence. I think it probably helped her that her husband was the warden, that he did have her back, or the deputy warden, rather. I think it probably helped her that Dial had passed on before her trial. I don't think his testimony would have helped. I think people, if he took the stand, they would have held that against her. So I just think the timing of how long ago it had been since she had done it, I don't know. I don't think she's a threat to society, if that's the reason we're putting her in prison, but I do think she needed to pay more than 6 months.
I don't think she needs to be around any inmates. That's for sure.
Absolutely. Hopefully, Deputy Randy Parker has moved off of the grounds.
I do believe he's retired, and I would definitely do so, especially if I'm going to continue to live with Bobby.
Yeah. Yeah.
Be at home with that woman all the time.
So she still claims that she was innocent. She still says that she was kidnapped and this was all out of her control and she was a victim here. For the second week in a row, John, we talked about it with Leslie Van Houten. I just don't buy it. Sorry.
Me neither. So I think she's as guilty as sin. That's what I think.
Man, we've been country today.
Just a swing. And go look up that song, guys, while you're at it. Go look us up on Patreon, because we have bonus episodes over there 7.5 years or so, if my math serves me correct. I don't know. Jamie's shaking his head no.
It's close.
It's close. Close enough for
close enough.
Horseshoes, it's hand grenades. But guys, thank you so much for tuning in, and especially thank you to all our Patreon family. We appreciate it.
Yeah, would love to know what you hear about this case. Maybe you have a different take on it. As I continue to find out on social media, people have very strong opinions for very bad reasons. So even if you have a bad reason, I'd love to hear what you think about this this Bobby Parker situation.
For sure. And until next crime, this has been True Crime Cast.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.